Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our coverage of the Elena Kagan confirmation hearing continues this hour. You have a choice, actually. If you want to just listen to the hearing streamed live right now or anytime today, you can go to our website, WNYC.org, and hear it there. We have some excerpts that we'll play that we think were particularly interesting from early this morning, and then we'll listen to some of it live as the hour goes along, and we'll get some analysis from Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. I mentioned before the news that Democratic Senator Herb Kohl of Wisconsin is in an interesting position today because even though he's a Democrat, he was the most outspoken in senators' opening statements yesterday about trying to get real answers from Kagan about her views on the issues, not just platitudes about being fair and open-minded. And here's one of the ways that he was trying to follow through earlier this morning. This is about a four-minute exchange between Kohl and Kagan, in which he gives her a multiple-choice question to try to get at what kind of justice she'll be.
General Kagan, to help us understand what kind of a justice you would be if you're confirmed, I'd like to briefly describe the philosophies of two justices, ask you which comes closest to your view. Justice Scalia considers himself to be an originalist who interprets the Constitution by looking solely at the text. He rejects the notion of a living Constitution and only gives the text of the Constitution, quote, the meaning that it bore when it was adopted by the people in 1787. In contrast, Justice Souter has criticized this purely textual approach as having, quote, only a tenuous connection to reality. He believes that the plain text of the Constitution as written in 1787 does not resolve the conflict in many of today's tough cases. Rather, Justice Souter believes judges must look at the words and see, quote, to understand their meaning for living people. Which view of the constitutional interpretation comes closer to your view, and why?
Senator Kohl, I don't really think that this is an either-or choice. I think that there are some circumstances in which looking to the original intent is the determinative thing in a case, and other circumstances in which it is likely not to be. And I think, in general, judges should look to a variety of sources when they interpret the Constitution, and which take precedence in a particular case is really a kind of case-by-case thing. The judges always should look to the text. There's no question that if the text simply commands a result, senators, you know, you can only be a senator if you're 30 years old, then the inquiry has to stop. But there are many, many provisions of the Constitution, of course, in which that's not the case. When that's not the case, when the text is subject to one or more interpretations, then often you look to the original intent and you consider that original intent carefully. An example of that is in the Heller case, the gun case, where actually all nine justices in that ruling looked to the original intent. They had different views of what the original intent was, but all nine of them thought it was important and appropriate to actually think about what the framers had intended when they wrote that language, which of those two meanings, the individual right or the collective right, they had in mind. But in other cases, the original intent is unlikely to solve the question. And that might be because the original intent is unknowable, or it might be because we live in a world that's very different from the world in which the framers lived. In many circumstances, precedent is the most important thing. One good example of this is in an interpretation of the First Amendment, where the court very rarely actually says, what did the framers think about this? The framers actually had a much more constricted view of free speech principles than anybody does in the current time. And when you read free speech decisions of the court, they're packed with reference to prior cases rather than reference to some original history. So I think it's a little bit case by case by case, provision by provision by provision. And I would look at this very practically and very pragmatically, that sometimes some approach, one approach, is the relevant one and will give you the best answer on the law, and sometimes another.
Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan, just a little while ago, with Democratic Senator Herb Kohl from Wisconsin questioning her at her confirmation hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. We'll hear more clips. With us now, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor for Slate, who follows the Supreme Court. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Brian.
She ducked. Senator Kohl tried to pin her down to saying what kind of a justice she would be by pitting Souter against Scalia and saying, would you be more like him or would you be more like him? And she said, well, it's not really an either-or kind of thing.
Are you hugely surprised, Brian?
No, but she did it very deftly.
She ducked again. There was a little colloquy also where he asked her to say, you may have just played it, I'm sorry, but he asked her to say who her favorite justice was. And he was visibly frustrated. I mean, he really looked like Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons. He was sort of like, just answer. She's doing a little dodging and weaving, which, as we've talked about before, she's the person who best indicted the dodging and weaving, in her Law Review article from 15 years ago. But she says that she was kind of wrong about that now.
And I guess she's acting kind of wrong about that. I guess this is a sort of, winners prevent defense. She's got the lead. She knows that she's very likely to be confirmed unless something goes horribly wrong today and tomorrow, and she's trying to just not say anything. Because this seems to me even more dreary from the clips that I've heard so far than the average Supreme Court nomination hearing over the last 15, 20 years.
Well, that's interesting. I actually think, as compared to Sonia Sotomayor, I mean, and maybe it's just being in the room here with her, she's very animated. Mm-hmm. She's got this sort of big, luminous smile that she keeps unloosing. She's made some jokes several times. At one point, she was questioned about that same Harvard Law Review article, and she said, oh, it's been a whole half hour since we talked about that, and, everybody busted out. So she certainly gives the appearance of being more comfortable than, say, Sam Alito or Sotomayor were before her. They mm-hmm. really looked like they were being, poked with sharp things for 4 days. And she looks pretty at ease, but I think on the substance, you're absolutely right. This is as thin as it gets.
She's just
able to make thin sound kind of jolly.
Let's dive into something as substantive as there could possibly be, and that is Citizens United. And Republican Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah just finished his half hour of questioning Ms. Kagan, and he focused, I understand, a lot of it on Citizens United and trying to get her views on whether a corporation should be treated like a human being under the law, whether a corporation should be allowed to make unlimited expenditures relative to a political campaign, an election campaign, as Citizens United held that they could. And we're going to play an excerpt from that coming up here in just a minute. But give us the headline there. What was that exchange like, in your opinion? Set this up for us.
It was almost the entirety of Senator Hatch's question period went to Citizens United, and he tried to get her to say, do you think it was wrongly decided? And she kept saying, look, I argued the other side. I defended the statute as it was. That was my job. I was SG. And then very, very quickly it turned into a fight about whether or not she conceded that books could be banned. And so it really went from a sort of global discussion on the propriety of the Supreme Court's ruling to General Kagan, would you be for banning books?
So we have two clips of the exchange between Hatch and Kagan. Hatch spent, as I said, almost the entirety of his 30 minutes probing on the question of Citizens United. And to many people, including our last guest, Noah Feldman, who had that New York Times Magazine article on progressive activism and the Supreme Court this week, there's nothing more important today than the question of government power versus corporate power as the constitutional issue of our time. So this first clip is from the very beginning of Hatch's questioning, asking Kagan about some of the written statements that she's made about speech and corporations.
General Kagan, I want to begin by discussing freedom of speech in general and campaign finance reform in particular. As you know, the first word in the First Amendment is Congress. I know that the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment also limits state government, but do you agree that the America's founders were first concerned about setting explicit limits on the federal government in areas such as freedom of speech?
There's no question that the First Amendment limits what Congress and what other state actors, executive officials, and can do.
Okay. The Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment protects some types of speech more strongly than others, and even that it does not protect some types of speech at all. Do you agree that the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that political speech, especially during a campaign for political office, is at the core of the First Amendment and has the First Amendment's strongest protection?
Political speech is at the core of the First Amendment. I think that that has been said many times by the court.
Yeah, I think one of the great examples, you versus San Francisco County Democratic Central Committee back in 1989, really came out very strongly on that. When you worked in the Clinton White House, you wrote a memo in October 1996 in which you wrote this. Quote, it is unfortunately true that almost any meaningful campaign finance reform proposal raises constitutional issues. This is a result of the Supreme Court's view, which I believe to be mistaken in many cases, that money is speech and that attempts to limit the influence of money in our political system therefore raise First Amendment problems, unquote. Now, as I understand it, President Harry Truman argued as far back as 1947 that a ban on independent expenditures would be, quote, dangerous intrusion on free speech, unquote. The notion that spending and speech are necessarily related is hardly new and hardly confined to the Supreme Court or even one political party. Do you reject the idea that spending is speech?
Senator Hatch, the quote that you read, I believe, was not written by me in my voice. It was a set of talking points that I prepared for, I'm not sure if it was for the president, for President Clinton, or if it was for the press office, but it was meant to reflect the administration's position at the time. The administration was trying very hard to enact the McCain-Feingold bill, and those talking points were in service of that objective. And so they weren't, my personal constitutional or legal views or anything like that, but was just a set of talking points that I prepared for, I think it was the press office, it might have been for the president himself.
Well, you were listed as the creator.
I created a lot of talking points in my time.
Okay, I accept that.
Orrin Hatch and Elena Kagan, and we have Dahlia Lithwick from Slate with us. He may accept that, but I'm incredibly frustrated. Here he is citing Kagan's own writing, working for President Clinton, that expressed First Amendment concerns around any attempt to limit campaign spending, free speech concerns. She says, oh, well, I wasn't writing for myself. I was writing talking points for the administration. And he doesn't even follow up and say, well, is that your actual view?
That's right. I mean, this is actually a very dangerous line that Kagan's having to walk. And we really saw yesterday that one of the things that the GOP is trying to go after her for was that she's a politician, that in effect she's had no real legal job. What she's done has been much closer to sort of legal policy advisor, and that, you know, the words they used were results-oriented and agenda-driven, and they're trying to paint her as a politician. And it's tricky when she says, oh, you know, they weren't even my politics. I mean, not only was I in a political job, not really a legal job, but, you know, my politics themselves are unknowable. So I think you're quite right. This could certainly backfire insofar as I think the more that Senate Democrats try to sort of resuscitate Kagan by saying, oh, she's a bridge builder, she brings everyone to the table, right, she's a consensus getter, she's got this amazing political skill, which I think is factually true, but the more they do it, the more they set her up to look like she's sort of completely craven and results-oriented. So it's a very, very much, I think, a double-edged sword. The more you play up, hey, it was just politics and I was just giving political advice, and that's going to be her answer, by the way, on the abortion questions as well, the more she runs the risk of looking like someone who doesn't really have any judicial experience or any judicial temperament at all.
So let's continue with Hatch and Kagan on questions related to Citizens United. Dahlia, you had mentioned earlier that toward the end of their exchange, the conversation got into the weeds a bit, not just on the difference between arguing on behalf of the government and personal belief, but the specifics of the Citizens United ruling and the question of books versus pamphlets, music versus movies, book banning came up. So here is another extended excerpt. This is about 7 minutes of Hatch and Kagan going back and forth in that arena.
But didn't you argue that the Constitution allows the federal government to ban corporations, union, and nonprofit groups from using their regular budget funds to publish pamphlets that say certain things about candidates close to an election? You did?
Senator Hatch, we were, of course, I was defending the statute as it was written. And the statute as it was written applied to pamphlets as well as to the movie in the case. And we made a vigorous argument that the application of that statute to any kinds of classic electioneering materials, not books because they aren't typically used to electioneer, but that the application of the statute to any kinds of classic electioneering materials was in fact constitutional, and that the court should defer to Congress's view of the need for this.
I accept that. I accept that you made that argument and that you were arguing for a statutory enactment by the Congress. But as I mentioned, you said that the federal government could ban certain pamphlets at certain times because pamphlets are, as you put it, quote, pretty classic electioneering, unquote. You said that pamphleteering is classic political activity with deep historical roots in America. Certainly some of the most influential pieces of political speech in our nation's history have been pamphlets such as Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Since in the Citizen United case you were defending application of the statute to a film, would you also consider films as classic electioneering?
Senator Hatch, trying to remember what our brief said, but yes, I think the way we argued the case,
that position.
It applied to films as well, of course.
All right. A pamphlet is often defined, at least in the dictionary, as an unbound printed work, usually with a paper cover or a short essay or treatise. In another First Amendment context involving the Establishment Clause, Justice Kennedy criticized the idea that application of the First Amendment depended on such things as the presence of a plastic reindeer or the relative placement of a poinsettia. Now, I believe he called that a jurisprudence of minutiae. I thought it was an interesting comment myself. Do you believe that the protection of the First Amendment should depend on such things as the stiffness of a cover, the presence of a binder, or the number of words on a page? Now, you can give an opinion on that since that case is decided.
Senator Hatch, what we did in the Citizens United case was to defend the statute as it was written, which applied to all electioneering materials, with the single exception of books, which we told the court were not the kind of classic electioneering materials that posed the concerns that Congress had found to be posed by all electioneering materials of a kind of classic kind. Books are different. Books, you know, nobody uses books in order to campaign. But
that's not true. Yeah, that's not true. And you did say the books are probably covered, but you didn't think they would.
I said that the argument was that they were covered by the language of the statute, but that a good constitutional challenge, as applied constitutional challenge, could be made to it. because the purposes that Congress had in enacting the statute, which were purposes of preventing corruption, would not easily have applied to books, but would have applied to all the materials that people typically use in campaigns.
I understand. In 1998, when you served in the Clinton administration, the Federal Election Commission sued Steve Forbes and his company that publishes Forbes magazine. Now, I have a copy of the Forbes magazine right here, and I think most people are familiar with it. Steve Forbes had taken a leave from his position with the company to run for president, but continued writing columns on various issues. The FEC used the same statute that you defended in the Citizens United case to say that these columns were illegal corporate contributions to Forbes's presidential campaign. And I know that the FEC later decided to terminate the lawsuit, and I know that this Forbes lawsuit involved alleged campaign contributions rather than independent expenditures, but the same statute was involved, and I use this as an example to show what can happen on this slippery slope of the federal government regulating who may say what and when about the government. Now, the Forbes case involved a magazine. The case you argued involved a movie. Your office admitted that the statute could apply to books and newsletters. You admitted that it could apply to pamphlets. Now, all of this involves the political speech that is the very heart of the First Amendment, whether engaged in by for-profit corporations, nonprofit corporations, tiny S-chapter corporations, or labor unions. Do you really believe, now this is your personal belief, do you really believe, I understand you represent the government, but do you really believe that the Constitution allows the federal government this much power to pick and choose who may say what, how, and when about the government?
Senator Hatch, putting the Citizens United case to the side, I think that there are extremely important constitutional principles that prevent the government from picking and choosing among speakers, except in highly unusual circumstances with hugely compelling interests.
Well, what's highly unusual about a book or a pamphlet or a movie?
Senator Hatch, I said putting Citizens United to the side, I argued that case. I argued it on behalf of the government because Congress had passed a statute.
You do believe it was wrongly decided, too, don't you?
I'm sorry?
You did take the position it was wrongly decided.
I absolutely said, Senator Hatch, that when I stepped up to the podium as an advocate, I thought that the U.S. government should prevail in that case and that the statute should be upheld.
Okay,
I wanted to make a clear distinction between my views as an advocate and any views that I might have as a judge. I do think Citizens United is settled law going forward. It's no question that it's precedent, that it's entitled to all the weight the precedent usually gets. I also want to make clear that in any of my cases as an advocate, and this is Citizens United or any of the other cases in which I've argued.
And I guess the end of that thought was that she was acting as a lawyer, and in the case of Citizens United, a lawyer for the Obama administration, and not representing her personal views. So that about 7-minute exchange between Senator Orrin Hatch and Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan from just moments ago. Dahlia Lithwick from Slate is still with us. She watches the Supreme Court. And Dahlia, again, a very, very interesting exchange, very frustrating if you're trying to get to her own view, but revealing nonetheless.
Right. I mean, this is part of what you were talking about, this sort of ability to back away from everything. So you saw her there saying, A, I was just doing my job. It's don't affix the position I took in Citizens United to my own ideology or politics. I was doing my job, but I'm not going to tell you my own ideology or politics. Moreover, whether or not I think the case was rightly decided, it's now the law. I mean, this was sort of the trifecta of all the ways you can avoid answering, right? It's happened. It's a precedent. I have an open mind, so it doesn't matter. And I can't answer anyway because it might come before me again. So you sort of saw there the greatest hits of non-answers. But one other thing that's maybe noteworthy, Brian, is that, you know, Orrin Hatch spent his whole time questioning her about Citizens United. But it's worth pointing out that as a political matter, this is a case that the American public really hates. So he may be there defending it. At one point, Kagan turned to him and said, look, take this up with Senator Russ Feingold. You know, he was the co-sponsor of this piece of legislation. This is between you and him as to whether or not spending should be regulated, and whether it's speech. But I think it's really worth pointing out, and this is a little bit of an interesting theme. Yesterday, to the extent that there was a theme, it was the GOP beats up on Thurgood Marshall, who was her mentor. She clerked for him, and they called him an activist, and they called him all sorts of things. Today, I haven't heard a mention of Thurgood Marshall, but defending Citizens United when the American public rightly or wrongly thinks it was a terrible decision strikes me as, again, not a great way. It may be a good way to get traction, you know, in the orbit of making the nominee look like a liar or a book burner, but I'm not sure a whole lot of Americans are with Orrin Hatch in terms of thinking that this was a great decision.
Coming up shortly, we'll play a clip of an exchange that just took place between Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California and Elena Kagan. Feinstein being a little rough on her around questions of presidential power in the context of terrorism and illegal detention. So we'll play that when we continue after a break. And listeners, I wonder if you want to call in, because we continue to hear on our comments page and our Facebook page that this is all theater and it's a terrible process. For example, Mary L. from Brooklyn just wrote, these confirmation hearings have become utterly idiotic. What a waste of everyone's time. So listeners, if you are skeptical of this process, if you are as frustrated as I was by that lengthy exchange between Hatch and Kagan and not really getting anything out of her, what would you prefer? How should we select and seat Supreme Court justices, in your opinion, if not this way? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll listen to Feinstein and Kagan. We'll take your calls. We'll talk more with Dahlia Lithwick coming right up. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and hey, Middlesex County and Staten Island, it's your turn in your anecdotal census of people's history of the New York City area from 2000 to 2010. Go to our website and write down the biggest change in your neighborhood over the last 10 years. What's the biggest change in your neighborhood over the last 10 years? We have a separate page for each county in our listening area. We invite your posts from wherever. But this week, we're focusing especially on Staten Island and Middlesex County, New Jersey. We'll talk on the air about how Middlesex has changed on this Thursday show. Then we'll do Staten Island next Tuesday. Join us in creating your anecdotal census of people's history of the New York City area from 2000 to 2010. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. We're listening to excerpts this hour from the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings taking place this morning with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate.com. And Dahlia, let's take some of these calls that are coming in from people saying how we should select and seat justices if they're so frustrated with the nominees not being able to give their views on the issues. So let's take a call. Greg in East Northport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg.
How are you? You have a great show.
Thank you.
I think it's always going to be theater because a Democratic president is always going to pick a conservative and a liberal, and a Republican president is always going to pick a conservative, and we as the populace know that. So it's always going to be theater. If you win the election and you have the opportunity to name a Supreme Court judge, I have to understand that goes with winning the election, and moreover, with the Democratic majority, she's going to be walked in anyway. So it is theater.
So why not, under that framework, have the nominee come in and say, I'm more liberal than conservative on issues of corporate power and how the Constitution views that, or Roe versus Wade, or one thing or another?
I think what happens when you want to be nominated for a Supreme Court justice, you don't know and you don't have a crystal ball of what kind of cases you're going to hear. And it's already assumed that there's going to be a liberal bias just by the president that you pick. And it's very difficult for a Supreme Court judge to really make a stand on anything, because if, God forbid, a case should ever come up, and that's now out there in the news, it could hinder the judicial system. So I think they need to be particularly vague, understanding that if you're intelligent enough to watch the hearings, you already know I have a liberal bias. I worked for the president that nominated me.
Greg, thank you for your call. And Dahlia Lithwick, did he nail it? Is it that simple, or is there any other way?
I think that Greg has just articulated what we're calling the Lindsey Graham standard, the one big defector at the Sotomayor hearings last year and again yesterday in opening statements was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who said exactly what Greg said. Look, elections matter. Republicans appoint conservatives, Democrats appoint liberals. And you defer to that. And his point was that it was always the case that the Senate understood that and acknowledged it. And barring some egregious, lack of ability, you take them and you confirm them because this is the president's prerogative. So Graham said that again yesterday. But again yesterday, he was the only guy on the committee saying it. So I think it's a very, very good point. The other thing that Greg says that I think is really, really interesting is that he's honed in on this paradox, which is, on the one hand, judges are political, and their ideology does matter. And the president would, of course, only pick someone that he knew to be of his own beliefs. But we have this aspiration. We want judges to be different. We want them to be umpires. We want them to, once they don their robes, to look at cases with an open mind and be different. And I think that paradox is always going to play out when the public is talking about the judiciary and even when the Senate is talking about the judiciary. You always toggle back and forth between the sort of sad, depressing understanding that, of course, this is politics and, of course, politics matter, but also the aspiration that maybe what judges do is different. And let's remember, most of the cases the Supreme Court decided this term were unanimous. You know, they do agree more than they disagree. And so sometimes that aspiration comes true, and it's not just bare-knuckle 5-4 politics.
Now, Peter in Brooklyn says, do away with the process. Right, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it basically gives all these senators a platform to stand up and thump their chests for their constituencies. And I think by doing away, it's not like what do we really learn during this process about the nominees? I mean, that we don't already know. Have we really learned anything that has made or broken the confirmation or lack thereof of a nominee? I mean, senators know whether or not they're going to vote for someone going in, so it really is theater, and it should be completely done away with. They should do an up or down vote once they've had a time to look over their body of work, and I'll take that off the air. So thanks,
Peter. Thank you very much for your call. All right, now here is one place we found, the place, Dahlia, where they actually got an opinion out of Elena Kagan this morning. The question came from Democratic Senator Herb Kohl of Wisconsin.
General Kagan, how do you feel about permitting cameras in the Supreme Court for oral arguments?
Well, Senator Kohl, this is actually something that I spoke about when I was as Solicitor General before I was ever nominated to this court. So I have expressed a view on this question, and I recognize that some members of the court have a different view. And certainly when and if I get to the court, I will talk with them about that question. But I have said that I think it would be a terrific thing to have cameras in the courtroom. And the reason, I think, is as when you see what happens there, it's an inspiring sight. I guess I talked about this a little bit in my opening statement yesterday. I basically attend every Supreme Court argument. You know, once a month I argue before the court. When I'm not arguing, I'm sitting in the front row watching some member of my office or somebody else argue. And it's an incredible sight because all nine justices, they're so prepared, they're so smart, they're so thorough, they're so engaged. The questioning is rapid fire. You're really seeing an institution of government at work, I think, in a really admirable way. And so I think... And of course, the issues are important ones. I mean, not some of them will put you to sleep, you know. But But a lot of them, the American people should be really concerned about and should be interested in. And so I think it would be a great thing for the institution, and more important, I think it would be a great thing for the American people.
Elena Kagan at her Supreme Court confirmation hearing endorsing the idea of cameras in the courtroom. And Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, that's it. Now she's not getting on. Her colleagues will never seat her if she wants those cameras in the courtroom because none of the others do, right?
Well, I think both Alito and Sotomayor have certainly made noises that are similar to Kagan's noise, that, you know, on balance, they're pretty good. I'll take it up with my colleagues when I get there. And as you probably know, the most vociferous opponent of cameras in the court was Justice David Souter, who said, you know, you'll have to roll them in over my cold, dead body. But he's off the court now. So I think certainly there's a growing sense that at least some of the justices would be open to it. But if I could just respond to both what Kagan just said and what Peter said in on his call, I think that when Peter talks about this as empty theater, it's actually worse than that, because I think the confirmation hearings are often the last time we ever see the justices again. And the notions we have of who these people are fixed in time from their hearings. And so we all think we know who Clarence Thomas is because we remember his hearings. I would say the same with Samuel Alito. The justices are not at all like that, and so I think it's worse than just theater. I think it sometimes shows the justices at their very worst. And as Kagan said, oral argument itself, and I've been doing this for 10 years, is astounding. It really shows the justices at their very best. And why is it in their interest or in anybody's interest to see the justices being dodgy and evasive and weird and dissembling when for the rest of their careers they will be, as she said, prepared and smart and, you know, really engaged. So it seems to me that between her point and Peter's point, we've probably pretty much established what's wrong with these hearings. Is why is it that the public only remembers the worst moment of a Supreme Court justice's life?
That's a great point. Although we have another caller, Mark in Jackson Heights now, who wants to respond to the previous caller, Greg, who said that it's all just theater in that we know if it's a Republican president, it's going to be a conservative nominee. If it's a Democratic president, it's going to be a liberal nominee. Hi, Mark. You don't think it's that simple?
No, I really don't. I think that Bush, especially, I think Reagan, they were unapologetic in their desire to nominate hyper-conservatives, what they called strict constructionists, what I like to call dead constitutionalists, constitutionists that aren't designed to evolve, which I think the framers fully intended. The whole process was about evolution. And I think instead Clinton and Obama both have made it very clear that they're trying to get a confirmable justice, i.e. somebody who's maybe a slight leftward tilt, but very centrist, very what they like to call confirmable, and not the fire-breathing liberals that the right-wing media would claim these people are in glee because they know that it's not true. And not the counterbalance to the Scalias, right, who are, let's say, intellectually conservative, or the Thomases, who are just thoughtlessly conservative.
Because maybe it's just not considered good politics to say it. If you're from the left, it is good politics to say it if you're from the right. Dahlia, do you agree with Mark? I mean, certainly I remember President Bush running for office saying that he would nominate justices like Scalia, who he really respected. And it's harder for a whatever reason in American politics, the Democrats don't come out and say things that are really the progressive equivalent of that.
Well, that's because we are sort of, I think, seeing the fruits of a decades-long conservative effort to reframe the debate about the courts, Brian. And pretty much since, I would say, the Ed Meese, you know, the real move to put conservative strict constructionists on the court, to roll back Warren Court precedents, there's been a laser focus on the part of the right, not just to put conservatives on the bench, but also to pretty much appropriate all the language of jurisprudence, you know, balls and strikes, strict construction, originalism, narrow, you know, and to decry everything else as activist and unelected and unaccountable. And I think we all live in that America now, and probably the best testament to that is Sonia Sotomayor last year, who not only sort of accepted the balls and strikes metaphor and the humility and the narrow application of facts to law and said, you know, all I do is apply precedent, that's the precedent of the court. I mean, we saw her bump, bump, bump go down the Republican talking points. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite true that, you know, when you hear Republicans on the committee assail Thurgood Marshall, he's probably is the left's answer to Antonin Scalia. But Antonin Scalia is somehow seen as within the mainstream. Thurgood Marshall has been painted, maybe caricatured, as way outside the bounds of serious judging. And so I think it's quite true that the debate has shifted not just on the court, but in the country and in our rhetoric, so that we all really, really want Ronald Reagan's vision of a Supreme Court.
And so in just a minute, because we have to take a break, and then we're going to play the Dianne Feinstein somewhat grilling of Kagan on the issue of detainees. What kind of justice has Sotomayor actually been in her first year? Has she been the, you know, close adherer to precedent and all of those cautious things you were saying? Or has she been somebody more progressive trying to make a mark now that she's outside the confirmation process?
You know, I haven't looked at the final statistics for the term, but I think up until, you know, yesterday, she certainly hewed pretty much reliably to the left. I think there are very few cases where her substitution for David Souter, another sort of pretty reliable moderate left justice, has made much of a difference. So I think that she is fairly, you know, aligned with that block of four liberal justices, but she's certainly not to the left of them, I don't think anyone believes. And in some cases, and we'll have to see going forward, particularly criminal cases, she may just be to the right. So to the extent that if anyone was hoping she was going to become the fire-breathing liberal Scalia, I don't think she's that, but I think she certainly is a reliable liberal.
All right. Coming up in a minute, Dianne Feinstein questions Kagan this morning on presidential power in the context of terrorism. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, speaking of predictable confrontations, it's low tension, predictable confrontations. Japan 0, Paraguay 0 after regulation. They're about to go into overtime. But let's get back to the Supreme Court nomination of Elena Kagan and listen to another excerpt. This is just from a few minutes ago. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California taking Kagan on the question of presidential power in the war on terrorism. And again, remember, she, as Solicitor General, has represented President Obama arguing for expansive executive powers in recent times.
So if I understand you correctly, you would say that the executive's power in this area is really limited by the specifics of the actual situation, if I understand what you're saying.
Well, Senator Feinstein,
the president does not have an overriding authority here.
Senator Feinstein, the way that the Solicitor General's office has argued these cases and the entire Department of Justice has is on the basis of statutory authority, is on the basis of the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. And we have actually never argued that Article 2 alone would provide such authority. And the question you raise really the usual framework that people use when they think about this question is something called Youngstown. So, of course, Justice Jackson's opinion in Youngstown, and he sets forth three different zones. He says, well, in one zone, the president can act in accordance with congressional authority, and that is the easiest for a court to validate, to say, look, Congress and the president are acting together. The president is acting in specific accordance with what Congress has told the president to do. The courts should give real deference to that.
Let me stop you here, because it's the three-pronged test. And we've discussed this in almost every Supreme Court confirmation hearing now. The concern is where there isn't legislation, and or when the third prong, when legislation may say the opposite, can the president exceed that legislation, and how strong is his authority? You say it's not the commander-in-chief authority, it's the AUMF authority that prevails. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, essentially what the Solicitor General's office and the Department of Justice has been arguing in these last 2 years is that we're in Zone 1, which is where the executive is acting with Congress's authorization, rather than in Zone 2, where the executive is acting and Congress hasn't said anything, or Zone 3, where the executive is acting as against Congress's statement to the contrary. So those would present very different issues, whether the president has authority to detain where Congress has not said anything, or still yet, whether the president has the authority to detain where Congress has specifically deprived him of that authority. That would be a very different question indeed.
Okay. Let's talk about that for a moment, because that's something I had something to do with, and that is expanding the exclusivity portion of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to say that the executive authority may not exceed, in statute, the confines of this act. Would you find that as binding?
Well, Senator Feinstein, I would have to, you know, take a look at the statute, but I would say that the circumstances in which the president can act as against specific congressional legislation, where the president can act despite Congress, are few and far between. And I think that that's what Justice Jackson said in Youngstown. And I think that that's what mostly the court has agreed with, few and far between. Now, are they non-existent? Well, suppose Congress said something like, we're going to take away the president's pardon power. A power that's specifically committed to the president by Article 2. I think that that would be a hard case. I think the court might say, well, you know, notwithstanding that Congress tried to do that, Congress can't do that. The president has that power, and it doesn't matter what Congress says about the matter. But those are very few and far between. For the most part, the presumption is that the president, if told by Congress that he can't do something, can't do something.
Okay, let me ask this. Does the president, in your view, have the authority to detain American citizens without criminal trial if they are suspected of conspiring to aid terrorists, of participating in acts of terrorism? Now, does your answer then depend on whether the individual is arrested in the United States or abroad? Because there's...
Well, Senator Feinstein, this will, I think, very much be a case that may come before the court, is the question of how detention authority, whether detention authority exists with respect to people who are apprehended in the United States. The court has not addressed that question so far. The court has addressed in Hamdi only a person who was actually captured on the battlefield. The court has left open the question of whether detention authority might exist for a person captured outside of the battlefield but outside of the United States, and also has left open the question of whether detention authority under the AUMF, now I'm talking about, would exist as to a person captured in the United States.
Elena Kagan being questioned by Senator Dianne Feinstein at her confirmation hearing moments ago. Dahlia Lithwick from Slate is with us. Again, I don't know what we got there, but it sounded a little more like she, to me, just an impression, it sounded more like she believed in this position on presidential power that she was taking and was distancing herself a little bit less from it than in the Citizens United case.
Well, I think that first and foremost, what we hear about Elena Kagan is that she is a great law professor. And what I heard in that exchange was somebody who was sort of teaching Senator Feinstein, well, here's what the law is. Here's what Youngstown said. Here's a good hypothetical, you know, explaining why Congress couldn't abrogate the president's constitutional pardon power. I mean, she's very, very strong when she's explaining cases, certainly on the question that I think most liberals were asking, and certainly what Feinstein was asking, was, what do you say about trials? I mean, do terrorists get trials? She said she wouldn't answer. So I think, you know, the important framework here, and I think it's what Feinstein was trying to tease out, is that the Obama administration has been seen by civil libertarians and liberals as being Bush light when it comes to these global war on terror issues, whether it's, you know, holding on to the state secrets doctrine or, you know, waffling on whether or not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is going to get a criminal trial in a court in New York. So I think that what some progressives are very, very worried about is she going to espouse this Bush-light view that she certainly has defended while she was SG? And right. I don't know that we got great answers to that today, but I can tell you I think that's the issue on which a lot of liberals are most concerned.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
The hearings continue. You can listen live on our website, wnyc.org. Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Paige Cowett, and Rachel Senator produced this program. We had intern help today from Alana Casanova-Burgess, Noah Litvin, and Constantino Stavaros. And our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. Talk to you tomorrow. I'm Brian Lehrer.